Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman, and Walker. A Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman, and Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. Rambana and Ritchie, immigration attorneys concentrating on complex immigration across the nation from Florida's capital and their mobile office. Self-sponsored green cards, I-9 compliance, and deportation defense. Rambana and Ritchie, on the web at rambana.com. And from the Florida AFL-CIO, representing over 1 million union members, retirees, and their families. Committed to building a better future for all Floridians by promoting healthy communities, economic justice, and dignity in the workplace. Online at flaflcio.org. From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
With time growing short, the Florida Senate tries tackling the contentious matter of perceived political bias on the state's college and university campuses.
We have always supported open exchange of ideas, both inside and outside the classroom.
Also tonight, a health care bill favored by the House gets some attention in the state Senate.
At some point in this process, this bill and the House companion, we need to work out the differences, and I'm not confident that this version will remain.
We'll also dig into the issue if placing at least some of the state's electric grid underground might speed hurricane recovery, and it's Prevent Child Abuse Week at the Capitol. I'm Tom Flanagan. Welcome to Day 2 of Week 5 in the 2019 Florida Legislative Session. This is Capitol Report. The Senate Education Committee has advanced a bill to explore what it calls intellectual freedom on college campuses, drawing the most debate of any item at its meeting. Ryan Daly reports other measures had an easier time being pushed through the committee today.
A bill backed by Republican Senator Manny Diaz looks to quantify intellectual freedom and diversity of viewpoints at state universities.
Requires an objective, nonpartisan, statistically valid annual intellectual freedom and diversity assessment by each SUS institution.
That assessment, per the bill, will come in the form of a survey for review by the University System's Board of Governors. It's part of a broader higher education measure that also makes changes to performance funding metrics. Critics of the survey want it gone from the bill. Democratic Senator Lori Berman filed an amendment to do just that. It was struck down by the committee.
This process opens the opportunities for political manipulation and could have a chilling effect on intellectual and academic freedom.
Berman says previous work by the legislature nullifies any need for the move.
Last session, we passed legislation offering full campus access to the right of free speech on campus, and all viewpoints can be expressed freely and openly, and there is no need for this survey.
Marshall Ogletree is with the United Faculty of Florida, an organization that represents full-time faculty at state universities. He says members of his group stand opposed to the survey.
And our UFF Senate, which is our governing board, doesn't pass things too easily sometimes, but passed a motion in opposition to this proposed survey unanimously. About 120 to zero.
Like Berman, Ogletree says protections for free speech are already in place.
Suddenly, we pass this. We have a survey. So students are suddenly going to feel that they can express their viewpoint. They already have that ability to express their viewpoint. What will this do to help that?
But Republican Senator Dennis Baxley, a perennial conservative voice in the Senate, says he feels there is great need.
I get all these emails from students that are conservative, feel very pinched on campuses around this state and around this country. I challenge the whole process by which the department chairs self-select people who think like they do, and you're losing, it's incestuous to where you have the same people that have all the same think, and you don't fit in if you don't think like they think.
The measure ultimately got the committee's green light with a unanimous vote. Another measure passed by the committee was Democratic Senator Janet Cruz's bill looking to place point-of-use filters for drinking water at all K-12 public schools. That's in response to reports of elevated lead in drinking water at aging facilities.
Members, we have safeguards in place to protect children from lead paint. We protect ourselves with filters on our own refrigerators, drinking water, and dispensers, yet we've done nothing to keep them from drinking water out of tainted water fountains in our schools on a daily basis.
Under the measure, schools built before 1986 would have a barcode installed at each source of drinking water to ensure filters are placed and adequate maintenance is performed going forward. Tallahassee allergist Ron Saff, who spearheaded the effort to test for lead in Leon County, says the legislation is the only line of defense.
In Florida and across the nation, there are virtually no laws that require testing for lead in schools, thus the need for this bill to be passed.
Saff says lead exposure can lead to things like behavioral disorders and ADHD in developing brains. Democratic Senator Bill Monford supports the measure but has questions about cost.
I thoroughly agree with the concept here. My question, though, is the cost. Are we expecting the school district to absorb this cost?
Wayne Birch, government relations representative for Pasco County Schools, had similar questions. He says for an already cash-strapped district, there are concerns about cost.
We would have 34 schools that would fall under the bill, and our maintenance folks costed it out, and it was going to probably impact us at about $400,000 to the district. So while this sounds like a good idea, I think our issue really is, you know, what kind of appropriations would follow the legislation to help us fund it, because we're already, you know, scratching to, you know, keep monies together to, you know, for teacher increases.
Even with her measure passing the committee unanimously, Cruz says a price tag has not yet been determined.
The fiscal has not yet been assessed on this.
Meanwhile, two measures looking to help schools and colleges reeling from loss of enrollment after Hurricane Michael breezed by the committee with the stamp of approval. Republican Senator George Gaynor's bill seeks to waive out-of-state tuition for colleges in the impacted areas. He says that's in the interest of recruiting students.
We lost 18%.
The tuition waiver would last for 3 years, and students would have to do their coursework concurrently without taking a semester off to take advantage of the program. Senator Monford's bill similarly looks to help K-12 schools whose enrollment took a hit after the hurricane.
This bill would hold Bay, Calhoun, Franklin, Gadsden, Gulf, Holmes, Jackson, Liberty, and Washington counties harmless this year in changes for their student population.
Both Gaynor and Monford's measures also passed unanimously. I'm Ryan Daly.
It seems education wasn't the only priority on the minds of Florida's state senators today. After initially being stalled, the Senate has started moving a House health care priority bill. The measure eliminates a requirement that hospitals show there's a need in the community before being built. But as Lynn Hatter reports, it preserves the requirement for other types of health care facilities.
Under the Senate bill, hospitals built after July 1st of this year won't have to go through a certificate of need process, as long as they have at least 100 beds, serve poor patients at a rate equal to that of other facilities in the area, and accept Medicaid and Medicare insurance coverage. Those newly added protections don't ease concerns for Lakeland Regional Health President Elaine Thompson.
Any of this commercial patient volume were to leave this underserved community, our ability to keep those big safety net programs there for the community would really risk lives.
Her Polk County Hospital offers programs for trauma, stroke, chest pain, high-risk pregnancies, pediatric and behavioral health services. Those services are complex and costly. Fewer than a quarter of the patients she receives have commercial health insurance. The rest are unpaid charity care or covered through Medicaid or Medicare. Neither reimburses at full cost.
So our ask is for consideration of maybe not wholesale deregulation, but to take a county look at counties like ourselves that are high government or no paid with very little commercial and that are offering these safety net programs, because there is no one else that will fund that if we see erosion of that commercial base.
The Senate's bill is sponsored by Republican Senator Gail Harrell. It keeps Certificate of Need for hospice centers and nursing homes. The House version eliminates Certificate of Need altogether.
So we really need to deal with some of the issues with Certificate of Need, but not throw out the baby with the bathwater. Let's do it carefully and appropriately. And I think this bill does it.
We have one chamber of the legislature that has made eliminating these laws its number one priority. And part of this process is trying to accommodate that priority, and I think folks don't understand that.
Rich Templin represents the AFL-CIO, and Democrat Janet Cruz says while the Senate's version of the bill is better, she worries what happens when the two chambers have to reconcile their proposals.
At some point in this process, this bill and the House companion, we need to work out the differences, and I'm not confident that this version will remain.
Hospitals say they prefer the Senate's version of the measure. Just a week ago, the House began moving a massive transportation bill championed by Senate President Bill Galvano. Templin and Cruz view the Certificate of Need issue as a trade-off to that transportation bill. Critics of Certificate of Need say it does not lead to improved health outcomes and stifles competition while keeping prices high. Those in favor of keeping the rules say they're needed to make sure everyone has access to health care facilities and to stop some from discriminating against low-income and poor patients. I'm Lynn Hatter.
Still to come on Capitol Report, lawmakers say burying Florida's power lines could save the state money, but opponents say that plan comes at a steep cost.
The way this bill is written will also shift the cost to consumers more than it already is.
And Governor Ron DeSantis issues a proclamation on this special week devoted to the prevention of child abuse.
My proclamation urges all Floridians to engage in activities that strengthen families and communities.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by the Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org.
Florida lawmakers want to make sure the power stays on, even in the face of major storms and hurricanes. A bill moving in the legislature would help utilities bury more power lines underground. But as Regan McCarthy reports, Floridians will still have to pay.
When a storm hits and Floridians lose power, Palm Bay Republican Representative Randy Fine says that comes at a significant cost to the state.
Because think about it, when the power is out, people can't go to work, kids can't go to school. The estimate is a third of the state having lost power for one day costs $1 billion.
Fine says that's on top of the cost associated with bringing in crews of workers to help get the power turned back on. He says that's something his district saw following Hurricane Irma.
We had armies of people come in from all over the country living in my area. We had this village that created overnight with thousands of workers and feeding them and housing them and getting them down. All those costs of getting our power back on, that costs money. And if the power doesn't go out as much, the cost to bring it back on go down.
And sadly, Fine says a power outage can even cost lives.
Certainly we have shelters and we have those kinds of things. But I will tell you, I remember the nursing home that called me and they said, we need our power back on. I remember the folks who lived in an RV park who said they needed the power back on. People are reliant on power, not just for air conditioning and not just to watch TV, but for their medical devices, their communication and all sorts of things. All of those costs go down when we improve the resiliency. I would argue that on a return on investment basis, we will never vote on anything that has as high a net ROI as a project like this one.
Fine says burying power lines underground could address all of those issues by reducing the likelihood that power will go out. Right now, undergrounding power lines is usually done by request and is paid for by the developer or homeowners association that asks for it. Fine's bill creates a cost recovery mechanism that would let utilities bill their customer base for the work in a separate charge from the base rate customers pay for power. And AARP Florida lobbyist Zane Smith says while her organization supports a strong grid, she worries the bill could do more harm for senior citizens than good.
Our members depend on power more than probably many people do. But the way this bill is written will also shift the cost to consumers more than it already is.
Smith says the cost should be included in the base rate. During a committee meeting, lawmakers pressed Smith on whether AARP members would really balk at an extra charge if it meant their power would stay on following a hurricane. And she says some would.
I think the answer to your question would also depend on the financial status of the individual member. We have some members that I'm sure would say, sure, add $25 a month going forward. But then we have plenty of members who say, we can't afford that. We're having to make decisions between prescription drug costs, utilities, and cost of living. So I don't know that there's a direct answer. I think it's a mixed bag.
Meanwhile, experts have pointed out undergrounding power lines comes with its own set of complications. When the power does go out, fixing an underground power grid can be difficult and could require digging in flood-covered areas following a hurricane. I'm Regan McCarthy.
While low THC cannabis or hemp is available in stores, Florida Agriculture Commissioner Nikki Fried says it's not legal, at least not yet. Legislation proposed in both chambers would change that. Today, the House bill passed its second committee. Blaise Ganey has the details.
Back in December, Congress passed the 2018 Federal Farm Act. It authorizes states to set up hemp programs.
This bill, 333, allows the state of Florida to set up our own program, and be one of the first states in the nation to do so.
That's Beverly Hills Republican Representative Ralph Masullo. He sponsors the bill. During a committee hearing, lawmakers wondered if Florida has missed out on the benefits that other states are already reaping. But Masullo says with hemp, the market is different.
Hemp is a very unusual product. Not too much time goes by in our lives where we actually have a demand for a business that is yet to be established. Usually it's just the other way around. Usually you develop a business and then you go out and look for the demand and you try to build up that customer base.
Agriculture Commissioner Nikki Fried is a big proponent of hemp. In February, she announced a cannabis director to regulate the industry. She wants to make sure the customer base that wants hemp or CBD, a hemp extract, gets what they are asking for.
The goal is to pass this and then create a program, in fact, so that way we have testing standards, we have growing standards, and then we'll have an opportunity for our retailers to buy it from licensed and authorized distributors here in our state.
Fried wants to be sure consumers don't accidentally purchase cannabis with a THC level higher than the legal limit. THC is the part of marijuana associated with euphoria. To make sure only hemp comes from these farms, a provision in the bill requires anything found over the legal limit to be destroyed. If a farm negligently grows cannabis over the legal limit three times within 5 years, Masullo says they will be banned from producing hemp for 5 years.
And it also requires DACs to deny license to any person who was convicted of a felony related to a controlled substance within a 10-year period from the date of conviction.
The vote received no down votes and is now headed to its last stop before the House floor. The Senate version is in its last committee stop. I'm Blaise Ganey.
Florida lawmakers are considering legislation that would ban so-called sanctuary cities in the state. The measure would require local governments to comply with ICE detention requests and to repeal sanctuary policies. Meanwhile, another immigration-related bill isn't gaining much traction. That one would require businesses to check the immigration status of new hires via a tool called E-Verify, and that tool would use an electronic federal database. On our last Florida Roundup, host Melissa Ross talked about these bills with reporters Anna Ceballos and Samantha Gross. We hear first from Ceballos talking about the sanctuary city bill.
When Governor Ron DeSantis was elected, he was very supportive of cracking down on illegal immigration in the state. And then now, you know, we're seeing Senator Joe Gruters, who's also doubling as the chairman of the Republican Party here in Florida. He's sponsoring legislation in the Senate, and the Senate, it's died in the past. The House has passed it 3 years in a row. Last year, they passed it within a week. It's amazing kind of seeing the changes in players, I guess, in the legislature, in both legislative branches and the executive, because there's a lot of support, a lot of momentum going on with these specific bills. or with a specific effort. And I think it's everyone who is supportive of this bill, it feels pretty encouraged. And so it looks like it's heading to the House floor pretty soon. And in the Senate, it has one more stop and then it heads to the floor.
Groups that are working pretty heavily to restrict immigration in Florida, they were involved in the drafting of the Senate proposal, weren't they, that would ban so-called sanctuary cities?
Influencing, I would say, right? I mean, it's they've been having pretty close conversations, at least based on my own conversations with the people involved and my reporting based on public records requests. We found that in January, before the Senate even heard the sanctuary city bill, there were emails between Senator Joe Gruter's staff and the vice president of an activist group that is pretty hardline in terms of limiting legal immigration and defeating what they say is anarchy in the immigration system here in Florida. And they've been, you know, focusing on getting this proposal passed this year. And one of the things that they tried to do in January was they tried to have their attorney tell Gruters, listen, we've read your bill, the one that you filed, and we suggest that you drop certain elements of the enforcement provisions in this legislation. And what they wanted was, or what they were recommending, was that the attorney general would be in charge of filing prosecution when it came to local governments who did not completely enforce federal immigration law. And, you know, when it was filed, it had state attorneys and the attorney general. And now the suggestion that they made in January, we can see it in the current version of the bill. And Gruters denies that they had any involvement in the drafting. But in this email, again, we see both that suggestion about having the attorney general have enforcement. We also see a list of what they call anarchy cities or so-called sanctuary cities in the bill analysis, which is like the official
in the bill
document.
Analysis. And let me, caller wanted this question asked, isn't it hypocritical to support sanctuary cities and not E-Verify?
That is a criticism that I've heard from lawmakers and from folks who are, you know, interested in this, that kind of show up to these meetings. They say that, you know, it could be considered hypocritical, but at the end of the day, you know, the E-Verify bill has teeth. You know, it would do a lot more than the Sanctuary City bill, you know, could likely do, because the E-Verify bill would not only require new hires to be vetted by E-Verify, but it would also, it has punitive measures for businesses that don't use an E-Verify system, and it would suspend licenses and things like that.
That was an excerpt from last Friday's episode of the Florida Roundup. You heard from reporter Anna Ceballos with News Service of Florida and state government reporter Samantha Gross with the Miami Herald Tampa Bay Times Bureau in Tallahassee. Money matters will dominate a good deal of the discussion at the Florida Capitol tomorrow, as we hear from Gina Jordan.
Here's what's happening tomorrow in the Florida legislature. Both chambers will hold floor sessions to take up their proposed budgets for the coming fiscal year. The Senate proposal is worth $90.3 billion. The House's spending plan comes in a little lower at $89.9 billion. Ultimately, the House and Senate will negotiate until they reach consensus on a budget to deliver to the governor. A House committee will hear about teacher preparation and retention. The bill would equip first-time teachers with tools and support by increasing opportunities for mentorship, professional development, and exam preparation. Hospitals may soon have to notify a patient's primary care provider within 24 hours of admission. There's currently no requirement that a treating physician at a hospital consult with a patient's primary care provider. In the Senate, a proposal to cut down on the spread of infectious diseases would enable county commissions to establish a sterile needle and syringe exchange program. The chief judge of each judicial circuit may soon be required to establish a military veterans and service members court program. Nationally recognized best practices would have to be considered when adopting policies and procedures for the program. And a committee will consider revising the requirements for Sunshine State standards to include financial literacy. high school students would have to take a semester course that includes personal money management. That's some of what's coming up in the Florida legislature. I'm Gina Jordan.
You're listening to Capitol Report from WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally tonight, Governor Ron DeSantis has issued a proclamation making April Child Abuse Prevention Month. He's also appointed the First Lady to chair the Florida Children and Youth Cabinet.
My proclamation urges all Floridians to engage in activities that strengthen families and communities and work to ensure that every child in our state lives in a positive and healthy environment.
The governor was flanked Tuesday at the Capitol by First Lady Casey DeSantis, Department of Children and Families Secretary Chad Popple, and members of the Children and Youth Cabinet.
And I'm also even more proud today to announce that I have made an appointment for service as the chair of the Children and Youth Cabinet, and that is going to be our wonderful First Lady, my wife Casey.
Casey DeSantis spoke passionately about her new role.
There are great programs out there for these kids to turn their lives around. It's just, do people know that they exist? Do they know that the resources are there? Do parents know this? If they find their child going down the wrong road, how do we communicate that message to them?
She then introduced Javonta Brown, who she said had turned his own life around with the help of a caring adult.
He is one of the reasons why I look forward to the opportunity to do some great things across the state with this cabinet and going and talking about best practices and how we can best serve kids. He shared his story with me going through 8 different foster care homes, how difficult it was for him, some of the setbacks he had, but some of the relationships that he made along the way with the Guardian Ad Litem office, and one person in particular who really was an inspiration to him.
Brown now has his GED. He wants to become a lawyer and a Supreme Court justice.
I'm here today for the 16-year-old that was told he wasn't going to be going home, or she wasn't going to be going home, just like I was 5 years ago. I'm here so that, hopefully, prevention can be made for them, so no family has to be dysfunctional.
There are currently 23,000 Florida children in DCF's care, said Secretary Chad Popple, and that's 23,000 children too many.
Child abuse and neglect is not someone else's problem. It's our problem, and we cannot be complacent. Children need you in your state, in your communities, and in your neighborhoods.
Floridians can help prevent child abuse and neglect by adopting, fostering, providing respite care, hosting fundraisers, donating, or volunteering as a children's advocate, and by writing their elected officials to ask their support for programs that serve children and youth. Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Ryan Daly, Blaise Ganey, Lynn Hatter, Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, and Sean Mulcahy. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Be sure to join us again every weeknight throughout the Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. For more information about Capitol Report and to hear previous episodes, visit WFSU.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman, and Walker. A Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman & Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. Rambana & Ritchie, immigration attorneys concentrating on complex immigration across the nation from Florida's capital and their mobile office. Self-sponsored green cards, I-9 compliance, and deportation defense. Rambana & Ritchie, on the web at rambana.com. And from the Florida AFL-CIO, representing over 1 million union members, retirees, and their families. Committed to building a better future for all Floridians by promoting healthy communities, economic justice, and dignity in the workplace. Online at flaflcio.org.